Hill versus Commonwealth, Shalef Ben Avraham, Senior Assistant Public Defender, Appellant's Counsel, Catherine Quinlan Adelfio, Assistant Attorney General, Appellee's Counsel.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Shalef Ben Avraham from the Prince William County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Richard Hill. I'm going to try to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, but it never always goes when you're up here that
way. Yeah, I hear you.
The main thrust of our what we're asking the court to do is overturn Mr. Hill's probation violation conviction. And it really stems to this. The initial finding of guilt and sentence in the case sentenced him to 3 years with 2.5 years suspended for a period of 3 years with the following conditions. And one of those conditions was then to do 3 years of supervised probation. That was in March 17th of 2015. In March 17th, roughly March 16th of 2018, he was found in violation of probation. The court, as this court is well aware, under 19.2306, when you find someone in violation of probation, violating their probation, and the statute says you shall revoke the sentence in full, and then you can do a whole host of things. The court gave him a year back of time to serve, and then placed him on two more years of active probation. We then later got the case of Mr. Hill again on another violation of probation stemming from 2019, which led into the litigation in February of 2020. That is what's at issue, is the second violation. The second violation, because the court did not extend the period for which the jail sentence or prison incarceration sentence had been suspended from that initial final sentencing, there was no suspended jail left when he violated probation the second time around.
And what do you make of the Court of Appeals review of this matter and the earlier opinion by Judge Bumgardner for the Court of Appeals that whenever a trial court actually issues a period of probation, particularly supervised probation, implicit in that order is that the sentence is suspended for the duration of the probationary period? Otherwise, it would be an irrational reading of the order.
Well, and that goes hand in hand, Justice, with Hartless and Carball, right? Which is that this period of which the suspended period is different and distinct from the period of probation.
I'm not contradicting that at all. I think that's exactly right. But the question is, if a judge simply says, as this judge did, I put you on supervised probation for 2 years. Now he's revoked the earlier suspension. So now the question is it an implied suspension with the probationary award? And two opinions, two published opinions on point, one over a decade old, says yes.
So the answer is that what we come down to is a serious problem with how the statutes interrelate and how they apply in this scenario, because there is a gap area. So when we look at the Jacobs case, right, the Jacobs case says that when you revoke someone's suspension, you don't negate the original final order or any of those conditions. And the implication is that unless they're specifically addressed, right? So just because someone's violated of probation doesn't mean the initial final sentencing order ceases to exist and it negates everything from it. And why we know that is it's one of the analogies or the hypotheticals I put in my brief is that if you, a trial court puts someone on probation and says, I want you to do a drug treatment program, and then that person violates and comes back, violates a new charge, let's say they get a DUI, and they come back and the court says, well, I'm going to give you 6 months back and I'm going to resuspend everything. In that scenario, because the Court of Appeals is now saying this is a new sentencing event, and because what was previously entered that you had to do the drug program is gone, that special condition is gone. We've now just put you on probation. Mm-hmm. That means the person doesn't have to do that drug treatment program the second time around unless the court specifically addresses it. That's illogical and doesn't make sense in what the purposes of probation are. And what we really have to get straight to the crux of this is we just need trial court judges to write better final sentencing orders and probation violations, that all they have to do is specifically say.
So this judge said, I put you on 2 years of probation, and obviously that makes no rational sense unless there's a suspended sentence attached to that period. And there's a Court of Appeals opinion on point, Judge Bumgarner's opinion, a unanimous opinion of the Court of Appeals saying, yeah, implicit in that is, of course, and it's a suspended term. I'm not sure why the new event concept tangles that very simple point up.
And this goes back to something the Court of Appeals also addressed, though, in the Silla issue from 2016, right? That when the court sets the suspended period of the jail sentence.
That was an unpublished panel opinion, and, you know, we would need something a little more persuasive to persuade us.
Well, Your Honor, it was unpublished, but that doesn't mean that its rationale and holding isn't the correct way to go. And the reason for that is because the suspended period of the sentence being a distinct and separate concept from the rest of it. So what you have is a scenario set up by the legislature in the codes that allows for this to happen. And what we're really talking about is what is the getting into the mind of a trial court judge as to why they do anything. And I would agree, and I said this in the trial court to the judge, I believe, maybe not in this one, in one of these other issues, that yeah, it doesn't quite make sense why you would just put someone on probation without having that coordinated term, the coordinated suspension period, because then it would be ineffective, which is what Heartless tells us. But under 19.2306, or excuse me, under 19.2303.1, that is something that can happen. And the legislature has said that a court can either do one of two things when they give a sentence. They can give a sentence and not prescribe a period for which that sentence is suspended for, in which case it reverts to the statutory maximum period. So take a grand larceny. I don't put that it's suspended for 3 years. You've got 20 years of potentially doing these probations. Or the court, in its decision, can decide to place a period of suspension on the jail that they have imposed and or suspended. Once that happens, it doesn't matter that it's not illogical or not. Once the trial court does that, it cannot change that. And that's what Reinke, Your Honor, which was, I believe, a published opinion that we get into a little bit in this, that the Court of Appeals cited to.
It can't change the suspension of the sentence?
He cannot change the period for which the jail is suspended.
Why can't they do that when they say, the sentence I'm giving you is conditioned upon you doing these things? That's our deal. Your case, in fact, in the order says it's suspended for 3 years following the based upon you following the following conditions. You don't follow those conditions, and the court says, you know, the suspension is gone. You had a chance to have a suspension, you blew it. Now I'm going to sentence you to 3 years right this minute, and now I'll have to decide what is that going to be conditioned upon. Am I going to suspend any of that? I'll put new suspension, or am I going to make you serve all that time? So the judge says, well, I'll tell you what, you know, you violated the terms of the condition I gave you before. I'm giving you all your time, but I will suspend it and then give additional conditions for suspending it. I don't see why it just wouldn't work that way. It seems like to me, just read the document, that's what it says is happening.
And Your Honor, the reason why is because the initial sentence set that prescribed period that the jail is only, that the incarceration is only suspended for a period of time. If the court had not
conditioned upon other things happening.
Correct. And so the response is the trial court found him in violation, can give him the 3 years. Could give him a year and a half back, could give him 6 months back, could do any of those things, could set any other new conditions it wants at that point.
And could suspend the sentence and suspend it for a new length of time if they wanted to.
Exactly.
I agree with the court. They absolutely could. The trial court have said, and you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give you 6 months back. And I'm now, though, what I'm going to do is I'm going to suspend the remaining 2 years, let's say, for another period of 2 years with 2 years of active probation.
Yeah, so I think we're at the nub of it. I mean, this trial judge did not spell that out, but
correct.
It's implicit in the probationary period, and there's opinions that have been on the books for a decade saying that that is the right way to interpret those orders.
And Your Honor, what I would disagree with, though, is the Court of Appeals specifically in citing to Reinke, which was an opinion on this issue, talks about, and the quote from Reinke is that the court on a probation violation of probation when it's sentencing is limited by only two things that it can do to the probationer after they found him in violation, which is one, give him a larger sentence than they originally did, right? I think we all agree that, you know, if you gave someone 5 years of jail and it's 5 years suspended, you can't now, after probation violation, give that person 10 years, even though you originally could have on the initial sentence. So that's number one. And the part that the Court of Appeals just ellipsed out is the second part, which is right in this case, which is, and the only other thing you can't do is change the period for which that jail sentence is suspended. Those are the only two conditions. So, and I will be blunt, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice, I don't know why Reinke did that in 2008. I'm not sure what their, if they looked at some legislative history, that's how they determined it. But that has been the state of the law, that the two areas on a probation violation that a trial court judge cannot change.
But Reinke, that wasn't the holding of the case. It was dicta in the case, and fairly expansive dicta.
I don't disagree with that, Judge, but I'm just pointing out, I think, why we're here, because the Court of Appeals cited to that as one of their main reasons
They cited the holding of dicta, and they arguably appropriately blew off the dicta.
Well, except that aspect of it is what is very key and crucial, Your Honor, to this, which is that the legislature has set the statutes out. And because the legislature gives the trial court the ability to set a period of suspension, once that period of suspension is set, a probationer is for the suspended period of the jail, the probationer is based his everything on that, which gets to kind of like the second issue that we have here, which is, I think, this court looking at final orders and determining how are we supposed to, when there is some discussion about what's meant by it, should interpret it. And specifically, what I'm addressing is not, and the Commonwealth in its brief talks about this is a 5A18 or a 525A issue. It's not. The issue was never raised in the trial court regarding plain meaning or parole evidence. It's because the Court of Appeals and its one judge per curiam denying it brought up for the first time the Lee case and tried to compare the language, that we brought up this idea that this court should look at final orders by judges and say that if the final order is unambiguous, you should just apply a plain meaning doctrine. There's no reason to look at it beyond that. It should be, if it's unambiguous, we just go with what the meaning is. So I see that I'm about at my 3 minute time. I want to reserve for rebuttal if I can, and answer some more questions. Thank you, Judge.
All righty, you have 3 minutes and 1 second.
Good morning. May it please the court, Catherine Adelpio on behalf of the Commonwealth. This court should affirm the decisions of the Court of Appeals of Virginia and the Arlington County Circuit Court because the Circuit Court had jurisdiction to revoke Hill's suspended sentence for conduct that occurred within the period of probation set by the Circuit Court's April 2018 revocation order. The Circuit Court's jurisdiction to revoke Hill's suspended sentence was established by Code Sections 19.2-306, paragraphs A and C, and this court's decision in Green and the jurisprudence of the Court of Appeals support the interpretation of 19.2-306 that the Commonwealth advocates today. Code Section 19.2-306 states that a circuit court may revoke the suspension of a sentence for any cause the court deems sufficient that occurred at any time within the probation period or within the period of suspension fixed by that court. By its plain language, paragraph A of 19.2-306A conveys jurisdiction to revoke a suspended sentence during a probationary period. However, today, Hill asks this court to read the clause within the probationary period out of the statute and hold that circuit courts may only revoke suspended sentences during explicitly stated periods of suspension. This court should reject Hill's argument because the Commonwealth's jurisprudence makes clear that this court presumes that the legislature has purposely chosen the precise statutory language and that it is bound by those words when it applies statutes. Because the General Assembly chose to use the disjunctive and to say that circuit courts can revoke sentences either during periods of for behavior that occurs during periods of probation or during periods of suspended sentences, circuit courts retain jurisdiction under both possible periods that may be set by a circuit court. And the period of probation is not limited by a period of suspension. In this vein, this court held in Green versus Commonwealth that a revocation could be based on behavior that occurred during a probationary period where no period of suspension was expressly stated. And as the court has noted, interpreting 19.2-306 6A in this way is in line with Virginia jurisprudence that addresses that suspended sentences are essentially coextensive with periods of probation, because to deem otherwise would render those periods of probation meaningless. To the extent that Hill argues that the terms of the March 2015 sentencing order controls and that therefore the court did not have jurisdiction in 2020 to revoke his sentence, his argument fails for a number of reasons. First, and this dovetails somewhat with the Commonwealth 19.2-306A argument, but Hill's three-year probationary period began upon his release from confinement. He was released from federal prison in December of 2016, and thus his probationary period ran until December 2019, and all of his violations occurred before then.
So if you, if I have my timeline right, if confinement includes federal confinement, which, as I recall, at the time of the hearing, that he was in federal confinement the day after because they transferred him. And at the time of the order, a week or so later, he was clearly, at the time of the order we're interpreting, he was in federal confinement, and the order reversed the confinement. So it's hard to imagine it's not contemplating federal confinement. But if that is the proper interpretation of the start date of the suspended term, were there violations with of probation within that term?
Yes, Your Honor. The violations occurred in December of 2018 and in the fall of 2019, and he was released from federal prison in December 2016. So the probationary period ran until December 2019.
So the next question I have is the Court of Appeals chose in a footnote not to address this issue. I don't know what your position would be on it, but does it matter about the suspension, the lack of a suspension language in the 2018 order, if there were violations in the original 2.5 years of suspension after running that suspension period from federal release from federal confinement?
Your Honor, I think that the court could affirm on either basis. I believe that the appellant has raised arguments that the three-year period of the suspended sentence ran from the March 2015 date, and that the suspended sentence did not run from his release of, I'm sorry, that is the operative time period within which the circuit court could suspend, I'm sorry.
So am I conceptualizing it right, then there are really two different models of debate here. One is, well, it was resuspended implicitly under the law because of the probationary period in 2018, and that gets game over. Or two, no, it doesn't, we even need to get to that. There were violations within the 2.5 year period of suspension when you run the suspension period from release from federal confinement.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in an abundance of caution, the Commonwealth has addressed both of those arguments on brief.
Was this argument addressed before the Court of Appeals? I saw the footnote, and it was unclear to me whether it was debated before the Court of Appeals and why that wasn't the nearest and best possibility of resolving the case.
Your Honor, I apologize. I was not counsel in the Court of Appeals, and I cannot recall off the top of my head. I believe that since the court, my guess is, well, I don't want to speculate, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I don't remember.
Fair enough. Thank you.
And just briefly, the court or the Commonwealth would maintain that to the extent that the defendant raises arguments involving contract law, those were not, as he concedes, those arguments were not raised in the circuit court, and therefore they are not properly before this court under Rule 5:25. Thank you, and we'd ask that this court affirm the decisions of the Court of Appeals and the circuit court.
All right, thank you, counsel. You have 3 minutes for rebuttal, 3 minutes and 1 second.
May it please the court. First of all, we're not conceding the contract stuff. I think it's a misunderstanding of what we're saying. We're using that as an idea of how this court should interpret stuff. I'm not saying there's a contract between the judge and the defendant for probation. And so it never came up in the trial court because the issue in the Lee case, which is going directly to Justice Kelsey's question about the timelines between whether this comes in the initial three-year period or outside the three-year period, was never raised in the trial court. The Lee case was brought up by the local Commonwealth attorney in the trial court, but for a different purpose and was addressed for a different purpose. The one judge per curiam that denied denied the initial petition, cited to the Lee case and said that the Lee case controlled the outcome of why the denial initially for Mr. Hill was. And that was that the Lee case's language said the same thing, that because the person was in custody and probation was upon the following, the 3-year period of suspension didn't start until the person was released from custody. There's a big distinction between Mr. Hill's final sentence and the Lee final sentence, which is what gets us to this, which is the difference is in Lee, it says upon the following is when the 3-year period would begin. Mr. Hill's case, and this gets directly to your question, Justice Kelsey, is it says with the following. So the only way, and this is why the plain meaning doctrine and the parole evidence is the point that I'm bringing up. When we look at it, it is much like when we talk about the LSAT exam, there, upon the following is something that causes the thing to occur. In the Lee case, upon the following was his release from incarceration.
So the judge in this case, in the 2015 order, wanted the suspended time and the probationary period and everything else to run while he was in federal prison?
Your Honor, what I would say to you is I don't know what the judge wanted in his head, and neither does this court. And that is the problem, and that is exactly why the plain meaning doctrine and the parole evidence rules, what we should be using to determine what those final sentences say.
Did the trial court later, the same trial court later, interpret that order?
The trial court did interpret that order and said something similar to what the court said. What is the purpose of me having done this if I had, you know, known what I had known, et cetera? But that's the problem. That gets into a public policy issue, which is that we need to have these orders be explicitly clear so probationers know exactly what we're under, so we don't come back 3 years, 4 years later and have a trial court judge say, well, I really meant this, even though it's nowhere in here.
Could you clarify for me what you're arguing, counsel? Because I'm a little bit confused, and I know it's the end of the ninth inning, but are you challenging the court's authority to enter the April 18th, 2018 order, or are you challenging the language of that order giving it authority to operate in the future?
I see that my time is up, and can I answer that question? So I am not challenging that he was convicted of a probation violation and the April 2018 order. What I'm challenging is that order in any way extended the period for which the initial 3-year period of his sentence was suspended for, because it didn't address that.
So you're not arguing that on April 18th, the original period of suspended sentence had already expired.
Well,
that's not your argument.
It had expired, but he was convicted for violations that occurred within his period. So I'm not arguing that. So he was convicted once of a probation violation, and that final order is that April 18th. It's when we come back in December of 2019, and I think the bench warrants were issued in November or September of 2019. When we come back in December of 2019, that there was no suspended time left to give him, which meant he couldn't be violated for probation, which led to this. So that, I hope that sort of clears that up. And I do see that my time is up. So I appreciate it. If there's no other questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.